in our local language. But I want to add to what both Adebayo and Purity said. I have a short quote here from Andrew Battelle. He said this about Africans. He specifically said it's about Angolans, but I want to quote it. They are beastly in their living, for they have men in women's clothing whom they keep among them as wives. I am saying this to say that whoever controls your language also controls your history and how it is written.
So when was this written?
This was in 1590.
1590?
Yes.
So these were how colonialists were describing the Africans that they saw?
Exactly.
Yeah, okay. Exactly.
So that was what I was going to say, that when it served the purpose, queerness was described as beastly, you know. And so because of that, it makes it a challenge to find like an objective description of queerness pre-colonially. So to construct how, you know, queerness looked like, for instance, in Ghana before colonialism, just like Ade said, you have to explore like specific contexts, specific parts of our culture. So when you take like the Ghana community that lives in Accra, Ghana, we have like the Sasu community that is a community of men. Sometimes they sleep with men, sometimes they don't, but they have like their own unique culture. And, you know, ethnographers have extensively worked with this community and have identified that you can't classify these people as gay simply because they engage in sex with men. They themselves, their identification as whether they are gay or not is very context specific. When you look at our religion as well, so for instance, like the local Ghan religion, we call God Atana Nyumo. That is a God who is both man and woman. That is like the meaning, Atana Nyumo. And it goes to like identify, it goes to show the kind of culture that existed. Like Ade also mentioned, our language, no pronouns. In Ghana, I haven't so far come across like a language that has pronouns like he, him, they, them. We don't have anything like that. Apart from that, there are also several unique queer communities that have existed in Ghana and have even been able to resist colonialism and still exist till today, like the Agonwole Ajele women, a community of women that marry, like a type of friendship that transcends regular normal friendship and is officiated, made official by marriage, you know. And it does not even have a sexual component, but it's queer. It's a very queer culture. So we have these instances, we have these communities, and they are not like within LGBTQ, like lesbian, gay, bisexuals. Agonwole Ajele would tell you that just because I am married to a woman, just because I live with a woman and we cook together, I take care of her children sometimes and she takes care of mine, does not mean that we are lesbians. We are not lesbians. We don't have sex. We just live in the same house. We are not lesbians, you know. And what is even more fascinating is that even among the Agonwole Ajele women, there are some that are lesbians. And they distance their bonding from Agonwole Ajele. They distance us from their identities as lesbians. So I could be married to Kweku as Agonwole Ajele and still have like a lesbian partner. Yes.
So what I find very interesting about all of this is that, and I'm sure that the case in Uganda is also very similar to Ghana and also similar to Nigeria in that we're all sort of linked by British colonialism. And we've all inherited you know, formal systems of governance post winning independence. And so how, I mean, it's been a question that I've had for the longest time, but how do you make sense of the cognitive dissonance of the general population that exists in this formal system that has to openly declare themselves as being Christian or Muslim in order to even win a presidency, all the while being informed socially by the culture that is anchored in, that is fundamentally queer, actually, that isn't actually in proper dialogue with this highly formalized binary system that is governing the country. Does that make sense, this question?
I think it makes sense. I think I get it.
And so you were talking a lot about people in Western region who you know, formally get married and are able to, like, sort of disrupt the idea of taking care of kids means that the other person that you're taking care of kids with, you're having sex with in order to reproduce, you know. There are people who have different understandings of God, for example, right? God people who understand God to be gender neutral. However, you know, if you look at the general statistics of Ghana, for example, most of the country is Christian officially, and or Islamic, and a very tiny minority is also traditional. But I suspect that traditional exists for everybody, right? You might formally believe in monotheism, but if somebody's casting a spell on you, you'll go to a witch doctor in order to fight the spell. So I was wondering, how do you make sense of the sort of contradictions? How people are existing in these two different worlds simultaneously, living in a world where there's only one gender. I mean, there's no gender in how you speak, but then at the same time insisting on the gender binary with Christianity and the formal system. Does that make sense, this question?
Yeah.
Okay. Hello. Do you want to go first? Or?
Okay, yeah.
Or Purity, would you like to go first?
Yeah. I mean, it also bothers me. Thank you so much, guys, for sharing. But it also bothers me of how the way of worship changed from a beautiful way of worship Africa had to this new way of worship that actually introduced, like, everybody has said, introduced gender and the normative way of people being against each other, you know? And if I can give you a contrast between these two way of worship, back home in Uganda, our traditional way, you know, you said witch doctors, they are not witch doctors. It's a traditional way of worshiping. It's a way of reconnecting with your spirituality. And, you know, God, whether it's a white God or whatever it is, whether it's Jesus, the white one, and everything it is just spirituality, you know? And for us, every household or small clan in most of the African countries had their way of worship that goes with their norms and way of living and how they are, situated and located. You know, it was universal in my own thinking, but we just had different ways of living, and it was okay. Everybody was connected. There were also a system of worship, but then when you connect it with the white God that I always call. It is a mystery of going away from something that everybody was related to something somebody has to learn for the rest of their lives. It was like worship was fluid. Nobody had to sit down in a book under the tree and you know, be educated that there is a Bible, verse 1, chapter 2, until the last verse. No, nothing like that, you know. Now, the Bible came confused, like, for example, for us who come from Christian countries, the Bible came and confused everybody. Mm-hmm. And until now, it is still being interpreted. You know, when you talk about, like, in Uganda, when they say, these queer people are practicing Sodom and Gomorrah. And then, you know, and then when I came to Sweden, I was like, oh my goodness, actually they're practicing Sodom and Gomorrah in the Bible. When I came to Sweden, I found gay pastors and they told me like, no, purity, it's not actually that. And I'm like, but you white people, which one is which? Why, which one can we go with? Like, who will ever interpret this kind of way of worship? So we can never understand it. Like, I am a spiritual person. Sometimes I go to church and it doesn't make sense. It's like I'm being against myself and who I am and everything. Mm-hmm. But when you go back to how we worshiped, it was fluid in a way that it was culture. It was a part of a community. Nobody had to learn how to worship. It was how they lived, how they were situated, the clan, the small circles. Worship began with family. Literally, in the family, each family had a way of worship, and it was interconnected. But now, there is also a mystery between what kind of worship is acceptable for us as African people. That's why you see, you call our traditional healers witch doctors. Like that, they're not witch doctors, actually, you know? Because everything is like witchcraft. Also, like, you know, I mean, like Christianity is like witchcraft. Who changes water into wine if it is not actually witchcraft, you know?
Yeah, right.
I
mean,
like, who turns somebody into a stone of, I think, a hedge of salt, Lot and the wife during Sodom and Gomorrah? I need to be there and see somebody turning into a hinge of salt and stuff like that. Who wants to believe that? So you see, but for the white kind of way, it is actually acceptable. But for ours, it is called witchcraft.
Yeah, it's you bring a point with this this contradiction, actually, the double standard. I do have to interject again. Forgive me, Purity, but we're actually literally out of time. But I think that maybe we can borrow 2 minutes to, if you guys would like to intervene. Just, you know, share your thoughts on this, but really limit it to like a minute or two, so then everyone can speak.
I think that one of the things the colonial process was very deliberately tried to do was to mirror gender and sexuality in, and I speak for Ghana, in Ghana, to how it looks with the West. So the same heteronormative binaries were tried to impose on Ghana. And so that was how, like, these labels, like lesbian, gays, etc. And you find that a core part of the Ghanaian society rejects these labels. So a lot of the research that has been done on homophobia in, like, Ghana, you find that people just do not like the terms gay, lesbians, you know? And wait, I've exceeded my 1 minute. Sorry, Ade. So I think that is all that I was going to say. Yeah, thank you. So I don't like working under pressure.
I'm sorry. But maybe we can come back to this after the break then.
I would love to.
If you could just give us a closing word.
I mean, it's very related to that, because I think the dissonance that you speak of sits within what you're saying, which is this idea of, like, conflation between identity frameworks and queer acts. And I think what oftentimes, so if we look at queerness, for example, like, everything we've described so far and how we understand queerness in these spaces, queerness is not who you are, queerness is what you do, right? And what happens is, when you start attaching what you do to who you are, that's where the tension begins. And that's where a lot of that dissonance that you're speaking of, because a lot of these spaces, like, you have a situation where we're now attaching queer identities to the queer acts that are being performed. So oftentimes what you find is the tension and the punishment that queer people are receiving isn't even always on the act itself. A lot of it is on the identities that are attached to these acts, and then the acts are being punished for that, right? And that's why in a lot of these spaces, a lot of these laws are largely unenforceable, because where do you start to begin to enforce some of these things? So even though somewhere like Nigeria, we have some of the worst laws was the Same-Sex Marriage Prohibition Act. But if anyone's been to Lagos, Lagos is one of the queerest places you will ever be in your life. Lagos is queer AF. F. And that's why. It's because these queer acts exist in tension with queer identities. So that, and I think that's, yeah, I'm just going to stop. But I think that's where that dissonance sits. It's with the, with that tension between identities and acts.
Thank you very much. I think I'll have to release everybody to go to break, but I implore everyone to come back at 8:40. Let's do 8:40, but really 8:40. Like, so try to get back by 8:38, so then we can really make it like the SBB. So we had a really interesting conversation about how the Bible confused us, and how many African languages or many African societies through the languages might even be arguably queer, and where many different African countries are existing with the contradiction of having formalized systems that are that are inherited from colonialists, while also living within a fundamentally queer society that isn't in communication with these things. But we're going to talk about now, I guess, the queer present and queer futures, and where everybody else fits in this. And so I'm just gonna go look at my notes again. And so I'll pepper you guys with questions. You guys can answer whatever it is you want to answer. I think this time we'll start with Awul, and then we'll do Purity, and then we'll do Adebayo. Adebayo, thank you. Thank you very much. And so the questions that we thought of, well, that I thought of were, okay, so given everything that we've discussed today, right? As histories had been erased or sort of modified by Europeans who attempted to heterosexualize Africa, right? Reinvent Europe in their image. What can be done today to reclaim or reinvent these histories? And what promises does the present and the future provide when trying to understand the past? Also, given the proliferation of bills and laws that particularly within these three countries, and how these leaders frame queerness as un-African, can reclaiming or asserting a queer present and creating queer futures be part of a decolonial struggle?
Okay. Hello?
Hello? I think it's on, yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Quirky. I'm just going to check my notes. Thank you. I want to find out if it's okay for you to repeat your question because I seem to have forgotten.
No problem. So the question was, what can be done today to reclaim or reinvent these histories that have been sort of heterosexualized by the colonialists? Because the colonialists were the ones who were writing about, the queer past and erasing local cultures. And what promises does the present and the future provide to understanding the past? And lastly, can asserting sort of a queer present and creating queer futures be part of a decolonial struggle for Africa? Or is this something that's distinct and that cannot be mixed with decolonial struggles?
Thank you. And thank you for not giving me 1 minute again.
No. You have 5 whole minutes, but don't spend it all in one place.
Okay. So I want to start from saying that, recognizing that even this conversation is the beginning of something. It speaks to the fact that we are also actively working to resist what has been written and the future, trying to shape our own futures. For me, as a community organizer, what I see and how I see queerness taking shape in the future is queer people getting to write our history, our own history. It's queer people getting to dictate how we should be identified as, you know. It is queer people finally finding our voices, because we already have the voices. It is us finding our voices and, you know, being able to assert, be assertive, so that we can push back, you know. I see the future of queerness in Ghana, queer people not having to be forced to identify as gays or lesbians before they benefit from the numerous community projects that we roll out in Ghana. Because of how we have contextualized the work that we do within gay, lesbian, trans, our efforts to build community lacks in a way. And it is because, like we said earlier, we established earlier, Ghanaians, Africans push back a lot against lesbian, gay identities. These identities have also been the basis for extreme homophobia and violence against queer people. Now, when you go on the grounds, when you speak with Ghanaians, what strikes you is the fact that Ghanaians are not necessarily like homophobic as, you know, Ghana is painted. It's not like you are a queer person and you go out and you get killed. But you find that actually Ghanaians have much more tolerance than we give them credit for. They just, and I don't want to even make excuses. I don't want to make excuses because I've been a victim of the violence that, you know, Ghanaians have meted out to queer people. I guess in summary, all I want to say is that I see a future where queer people in Ghana get to identify ourselves as what we are. And also we get to like benefits, and our identification is not the basis on which we get, you know, liberation. Thank you.
So if I can just give you a dreaded minute, if our identity is not how we, the basis that we can get liberation, what do you think is the basis for that liberation?
I think the fact that we are people should be enough. Honestly, queerness is othered because colonialism says queerness is othered, just like Adebayo said. Up until the introduction of the Offences Against the Persons Act Bill in, was it 1875, by British in all of its colonies, there wasn't anywhere like homosexuality, you know. There were no gays, there were no lesbians. I mean,
and there were no straights.
Those words. And there were no straights. So queerness, I would say, was society. You know, it was as normal as two straight people getting married, because like even to date, Agunwole Ajayi's women still marry. Yeah, that is how I see it. Yeah.
Thank you. If we can, Purity, would you like to intervene or?
Yeah, sure.
Thank you very much, Purity.
You're most welcome. I mean, the present for African queer community is painful, but the future is very promising. To be very honest, we can no longer be closeted, and the closets can no longer contain us. I see it in Uganda. When all these laws have been formulated, I have seen a community that is so resilient. You know, people who are almost at the edge of everybody being raised, but then they remain resilient. And for me, that resilience, that organizing, And even us who couldn't stay and had to go away, and then we are seeing how much lost we are, how much we miss our histories and how much we miss who we were, and now we are in spaces that actually are not meant for us. There is a future that we shall go back and discover, oh, literally all this actually paid off. And you can begin with bad media. All the bad media, you know, talks about everything to be with to do with queerness in Africa, as death, people are dying and stuff like that. Well, the ones that are dying are sacrificing their lives for us. But there is a big community out there. There is everybody, you know, we are having children. I am glad that Africa still thinks about giving birth to children and more than anybody else. Our siblings are coming up, our children are coming up, and there is a future that will not contain us. This bad publicity, for example, now Uganda is at the helm of bad laws that have been enacted. But now what about that conversation? That conversation is the start of our future, because somebody knows. And then also reclaiming our history. We are being told that our history doesn't make sense. It's actually being told by a white person. And it is told in so many ways because they are the ones who have the money. Even in the queer activism, the West, you know, we are the ones who don't have the money. We are always the beneficiaries. Even when somebody's writing a book, it's a white person writing and asking us, you know, what to write when it comes to who we are and stuff like that. And there should be a future where we refuse to actually be beneficiaries, but be a part of letting the white people be in the underground supporting us. Because at the end of the day, all these laws affects them, affects all of us globally. You know, allow them be in the underground and allow us be on the forefront and reclaim us. It's not funny, always see a white person being the one praised about our pain and what we are building. Our communities are so resilient and building a history and a legacy. But then we are always led by the whiteness that comes with it. And the rewiring of our mindset has to change also as queer Africans, you know? Because if we think about Africa being naturally queer, like Adebayo said, we are starting not to believe it. Through what we see, through coping cultures, and also like for us who are in diaspora, we are forced to integrate into communities actually we can never fit in. And that's okay. But it doesn't take away so much from us, knowing where we come from. Then the other one, how we can reclaim our histories and who we are is one, to start doing work but getting gain out of it. I hate it when we are all, most of the, every queer, black queer person who is out is an activist by default. No in between. Everybody is an activist by default. So long as you have come out, you become an activist. And you don't become an activist because you want, you are an activist beginning with yourself. You want to stay alive, you want to stay, you don't want to die, like you are doing so much. But everything we do, even in this Western world, we are not actually paid. We are the ones, when we talk about financial freedom, we don't earn the money. I no longer want to see us being volunteers. Even in these spaces, I would love to challenge you enough that I wish we start even telling these donors that if you want to have purity on the panel, she needs to get paid. She doesn't have to go back and struggle to take care of her views and also represent her community. This, what we do, should be able to give us a platform. Our communities have actually given up. I need to keep emphasizing that our communities, our activists are worn out. They are the ones, when we go into the dynamics and also the percentages, we are the ones doing all the dirty work and then coming on the forefront. Dirty work and coming on the forefront. So if we begin to start also claiming to, one, take care of ourselves, be able take care of ourselves, and we are not supposed to be the ones volunteering. We are supposed to be the ones earning because we deserve the money. Otherwise, if we continue the black tax, we are the ones who do the black tax.